Radio EcoShock.
What if climate change washed more of a certain neurotoxin into the oceans? What could happen to ocean life or to us? Are you ready to explore? Our guide is a scientist in Sweden, Dr. Erik Bjorn, is a chemist and biochemist in the Marine Sciences Lab at Umeå University. He's a researcher and co-author of a paper that might not go far in the newspapers or TV, but it is news, and I think it's big news. Erik Bjorn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Your paper describes more and more organic material running into the sea as the climate shifts. Why will that happen?
So basically, this will happen because of increased precipitation, rainfall, in certain regions of the world. And this increased rainfall will then basically wash out more organic matter from soils to aquatic ecosystems.
How much more will flow into the ocean? I mean, is this a big process or a slight increase?
It's projected to be very different for different regions of the world where climate scientists are working with different climate scenarios. But the one that we are mainly discussing in the paper projects changes from 50% decreases in runoff up to 50% increases in runoff for different parts of the world by the end of this century as compared to the conditions today or a decade ago. So a large range for different regions in the world.
Were you able to add it up globally so we know whether there's a net increase or decrease?
I have to confess that I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Now, we're going to talk about a chemical called methylmercury. What is that?
So basically, it is a organic mercury compound. I mean, mercury is an element, of course, that occurs naturally and which is spread to ecosystems both by natural processes and by anthropogenic activities. And in the environment, mercury can be transformed to this organic form, methylmercury, by certain types of microorganisms. And methylmercury is a strong nevrotoxic compound which can then be accumulated in aquatic food webs to high concentrations in top predators.
You know, humans always want to hear about themselves first. So what is the impact of methylmercury on human health?
The major impact is that since it is a nevrotoxic compound, it causes those type or various types, I should say, of nevrotoxic effects. And of course, as often, infants and children are most vulnerable, and it can negatively affect learning abilities and IQ for children. So it is a severe toxic compound, and it's, for example, classified by the World Health Organization as one of the top 10 chemicals of public health concern. Maybe I can also mention that in relation to the processes of accumulation in the aquatic food web, the main exposure route for humans to methylmercury is then through consumption of certain fish species, not all types of fish, but some fish species.
Would tuna be an example?
Tuna is one example, yes.
So what happened in Minamata, Japan, that gave this environmental poisoning a name?
So there it was actually accidentally released from a factory and contaminated a large coastal region. I mean, normally methylmercury is not released into the environment by anthropogenic processes. It is formed in the environment. But in this case, in Minamata in Japan, it was released very large amounts of methylmercury to a coastal area, contaminating the fish in that ecosystem that a lot of people were eating.
Two things surprised me right off the bat about your work. The first is the location of your university. For those who don't know, Umeå University is in central to northern Sweden, up along river estuary from the Gulf of Bothnia, off the Baltic Sea. Why is your unit working on the health of global seawater?
So I think it's important to note that the effects we are describing in this paper will not be a global phenomenon. It is an effect that might occur in certain regions and certain types of ecosystems. For example, with the level of knowledge we have today, we believe that the ecosystem in the northern Baltic Sea could be vulnerable to these effects. From what we know today, we expect that coastal regions in the northern part of the northern hemisphere, so Canada, northern United States, Scandinavia, Russia, would be the most vulnerable regions and ecosystems to these effects. So we expect that we might have this problem in our local region here in the northern Baltic Sea.
Well, that makes sense. The second surprise to me was your lab. You know, some of my guests make climate discoveries using computer models or assessing many other studies. But a video provided by the university shows you walking among large vats with a lot of measuring equipment. What is in the vats and what are you looking for?
Right, yeah. So what it is indeed an experimental study. And so what is shown in the video is the so-called Mesocosm Research Facility at the Umeå Marine Sciences Center. And basically this research facility, it consists of 12 big plastic tubes, which are about 1 meter in diameter and 5 meters high. And what we did in our study is that we filled these big black tubes with sediment at the bottom and then a 2,000 liter, 5 meter high water column. And then in this system, you can control temperature, light conditions, additions of nutrients, and then in our case also terrestrial organic matter, so that we basically, under well-controlled conditions, construct different types of aquatic model ecosystems. That's basically what this facility is designed for. And then in our case, what we did was that we added isotopically enriched mercury tracers, so stable isotopes, not radioactive isotopes, of mercury into the sediment and into the water. And then we basically studied how methyl mercury was formed and how it was accumulated in the food web. So we had food webs up to zooplankton in this experiment for different types of model ecosystems.
Well, that's something that worried me in your new science. My alarm bells went off when the paper described a change taking place between zooplankton and bacteria. What did you find there?
So what we found was what happens when we add this terrestrial organic matter, as we talked before, what happens is that there is a change in the structure of the food web, because basically the water gets brown colored. So there is less light penetration through the water, which then decreases the production of phytoplankton through photosynthesis. And instead, there is an increased growth of bacteria in the water column, which, of course, don't need light, and they can instead directly use this organic matter, this terrestrial organic matter. And what happens then is that there is a shift or a change in the structure of the food web, so that it goes from being based on phytoplankton to being based by bacteria. When that happens, there also is it establishes or develops a new trophic level of organisms, protozoa organisms that feed on the bacteria. So on average, there are a longer food chain when it starts with bacteria compared to when it starts with phytoplankton. So there are more steps in the food chain when it's based on bacteria. And methyl mercury is enriched in each such step in the food chain. So therefore, you then eventually get higher concentrations when you reach predatory organisms such as zooplankton, and in the next step then fish.
We're talking with Dr. Erik Bjorn from the Marine Sciences Lab at Umeå University in Sweden. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. I would like to talk to you about the human sources of methylmercury. There seems to be, if you give me a second, a conflict between the information in Wikipedia and what I'm getting from your paper. Wiki says, quote, "Much, if not most, of the distributed mercury dispositional input is from natural sources. Pre-Anthropocene tissue-bound levels in fish may not have differed markedly from current levels, bringing it into question whether economically and environmentally expensive political regulatory measures would be ineffectual and moot." What are your comments on that, Erik Bjorn?
So first, I would say this: we do not investigate, of course, the sources of mercury in this particular paper that we are talking about here. And would also like to note that irrespective of where the mercury is originating from, one would basically have the same effects in you, if you have these changes in food web structure. But when it comes to the origin of mercury, there are still intense ongoing research trying to constrain the numbers on how big fraction is originating from natural sources and how big fraction is originating from anthropogenic sources. I have to admit that I haven't actually read that quote from Wikipedia. It surprises me a little bit. I would say that our current best scientific knowledge suggests that a larger fraction originates from anthropogenic sources than what was stated there.
That's what I was getting from your paper. And you also discuss there other land changes by humans which affect the runoff of even the naturally occurring methylmercury. Can you talk about those?
One example, and which we are also working with in our research groups, is the effect of forestry. For example, when forests are being clear cut, there is also an increase in runoff and also input of terrestrial organic matter and also mercury from the terrestrial landscape and to the aquatic ecosystems. So that is one such example, which is also another, say, focus research area for our research groups in UMIO.
And once this methylmercury hits the sea, Eric, in 1,000 places, does it stay more concentrated along the coast where most fishing occurs, or does it disperse towards some sort of balance in the oceans?
The input from the terrestrial landscape is mainly impacting the coastal zones, and exactly how large zones, of course, will vary from different regions. Then in the open oceans, the direct impact from terrestrial input, of course, is small, but still there are significant concentrations of methylmercury in the open oceans, and it's still actually not fully clarified what the origin of that methylmercury is. If it is formed in the ocean water by the same or similar processes and microorganisms as it's formed in soils and sediment, or if it is through other mechanisms. So that's also an important and still unresolved research question.
Interesting. Well, now that we know about this process and its possible increase under climate change, is there anything we can do about it?
In our study, we do not reach a stage where we propose any specific actions directed towards this specific phenomenon. Since it is a general phenomenon in the type of regions where it would occur, it's, at least for me, a bit difficult to see what effective specific actions one could do to direct this specific process. So what we would emphasize is the need to reduce anthropogenic mercury emissions, which hopefully will be the case through the implementation of the Minamata Treaty, a big international legally binding treaty, which is signed by, I think, more than 130 countries now, with the intent to largely reduce anthropogenic mercury emissions, which I would say are very large contributions to the total mercury emissions. And the second thing, of course, to minimize the impact on changes in the future climate.
Yes, and I would have to say as a climate activist myself that the coal plants are a large source of mercury into the environment, and if those happen to close down because of, say, the Paris Accords or other reasons, that might also help the situation.
Yes, when it comes to coal combustion, I think it's also, with respect to mercury emissions, it is promising that there is now developed technology to remove mercury from the flue gases before they are emitted. So there, I would say we have the technology to a very large extent remove that source of mercury emissions.
Right. So when new coal plants are being built, we have to ask, are there mercury scrubbers? And that would help.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners?
I think we could talk about this for a long time. Maybe I would add how we look upon this study that we have made is that we believe that we are we are contributing with a new piece of very important knowledge in order to be able to predict how global climate changes in the future might affect the exposure of toxic methyl mercury both to ecosystems and to humans. And this is something that we think that will be important to use both for scientists and for policymakers. And we ourselves are continuing quite intense research work in this direction. What we want to do is, now of course climate scientists are working with different climate scenarios. So an important next step for us is to try to be able to better predict how large these effects of increased methyl mercury exposure might be for different climate scenarios. And we would also like to try to better understand exactly which geographical regions and which type of ecosystems might be most vulnerable to this effect in the future.
So we could map it out, perhaps?
Yes, ultimately that would be one important aim of this work.
We've been talking with Dr. Erik Bjorn, and the paper in the journal Science Advances is titled Terrestrial Discharges Mediate Trophic Shifts and Enhance Methylmercury Accumulation in Estuarine Biota. It was published January 27, 2017. You can find links to that paper and everything we have talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Erik, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.